Sign up at joinpacman.com, become a member. You can use the coupon code BIGVOTING22 to save bigly. And we will see you on today's bonus show, or if you're not a member.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Techno Land? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
My fellow Americans, I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call, jazz. Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-song word.
WRCT, in sound, from way out.
My fellow Americans, I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
RCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best. The smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call, jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-song word.
It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in techno DJs in the house!
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!, another mass shooting. Four people have been shot dead in Tulsa, Oklahoma, after a gunman attacked a medical complex. It's the 20th mass shooting in the United States since the school massacre in Ovalle, Texas, killed 19 fourth graders and two teachers last Tuesday. We'll look at an issue seldom discussed, the role of the United States as the world's leading weapons exporter. We'll speak to international arms control advocate Rebecca Peters and media critic Norman Solomon.
There's a crying need for gun control, not only in the United States, but also around the world. And that includes gun control at the Pentagon, which routinely, unfortunately, is killing innocent civilians. But what they're doing at the Pentagon is not talked about in terms of gun control.
Then to Ukraine. Nearly 100 days after Russia's invasion began, the United States warns the war could continue for many more months.
We can't predict how this is going to play out, when this is going to play out. As best we can assess right now, we are still looking at many months of conflict.
We'll speak to Anatole Levin. His latest piece in The Atlantic, Cold War Catastrophes the U.S. Can Avoid This Time. Plus, the climate emergency and the war in Ukraine are leading to a devastating global hunger crisis. Oxfam says one person is likely dying from hunger every 48 seconds in drought-ravaged Ethiopia, Kenya, and Somalia alone. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Tulsa, Oklahoma, a man armed with a rifle and a handgun stormed a medical office building on Wednesday, killing four people, wounding others before turning the gun on himself. Police have not identified the shooter. They said the attack was not random, but are withholding other details. Michelle Nathan witnessed the aftermath of the assault.
Sad. I was coming to the doctor, and I got my grandkids with me in this terrible scene. It's awful. It's sad. My daughter-in-law is from Buffalo, so now it's so close to home. It's not even safe if you come outside anymore, you know. My prayers go out to everyone that's in that building.
According to the Gun Violence Archive, the Tulsa attack was the 233rd mass shooting since January 1st. There have been at least 20 mass shootings since last week's massacre of 21 people at the Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas. In Buffalo, New York, a white man accused of murdering 10 black people in a supermarket May 14th was indicted Wednesday on 25 counts, including domestic terrorism and murder as a hate crime. Prosecutors say the 18-year-old was radicalized through online forums such as 4chan, authored a racist manifesto, live-streamed his shooting spree. If convicted, the white supremacist gunman will face an automatic sentence of life in prison without parole. In Uvalde, Texas, hundreds of mourners gathered Wednesday for the funeral of Irma and Joe Garcia. Irma was killed alongside another teacher and 19 fourth graders last week at Robb Elementary School by a teenage gunman with an assault rifle. 2 days after her murder, her husband, Joe, died of a fatal heart attack. They're survived by four children. The funeral came as public anger mounted over the response of police, who waited over an hour to enter the classroom where the massacre took place. On Wednesday, it emerged that the Uvalde School District Police Chief, Pete Arredondo, the incident commander, told a team of Border Patrol officers not to enter the classroom where the gunman killed 21 people. The officers eventually defied the order, engaging and killing the gunman. The Texas Department of Public Safety says Arredondo is refusing to cooperate with its investigation. But Arredondo told CNN he'll talk about the massacre when, quote, families quit grieving. In Austin, Texas, Governor Greg Abbott is resisting demands by state Democrats that he convene a special legislative session to tackle gun violence. Abbott called Wednesday instead for the formation of a special legislative committee. The Texas State Teachers Association blasted the move, writing in a statement, "Committees and other groups have studied school safety before, and schools obviously aren't safe from mass shooters. This is because the governor and legislators refuse to address the real issue and enact reasonable gun laws to keep guns out of the hands of people who shouldn't have them," they said. Meanwhile, a bipartisan group of 9 U.S. senators met Wednesday to discuss new legislation in the wake of the Uvalde massacre. Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky said he hoped lawmakers would target what he called the source of U.S. mass shootings.
Seems to me there are two broad categories that underscore the problem: mental illness and school safety.
He did not mention guns as a source of mass shootings. Ukraine says Russian forces have taken over most of Severodonetsk, the last major city under Ukrainian control in the Luhansk region. The city's fall to Russia comes as the United Nations warns the invasion of Ukraine has caused the deaths of at least 2 children every day, with many more injured. On Thursday, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky admitted Russia's killing up to 100 Ukrainian soldiers a day, with another 500 wounded daily. Meanwhile, the Wall Street Journal reports hundreds of Russian soldiers have escaped the fighting in Ukraine or refused to take part during the early stages of the war. On Wednesday, the Biden administration announced another $700 million worth of military aid to Ukraine, including the delivery of advanced rocket launchers and more Javelin anti-tank missiles. Meanwhile, Reuters reports the administration's considering a plan to sell armed attack drones to Ukraine. This comes as about 1,000 Russian troops held nuclear weapons drills northeast of Moscow on Wednesday. We'll have the latest on Ukraine after headlines. In the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces shot and killed 31-year-old Palestinian journalist Gufran Harun Hararasneh on Wednesday as she commuted to her new job at a radio station in the city of Hebron. The Israeli army claims she was holding a knife, but eyewitnesses disputed the army's description of what happened. The Palestinian foreign ministry accused Israel of carrying out an execution. This comes just 3 weeks after the Israeli military shot dead the Palestinian-American journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. Israeli forces also killed 2 more Palestinians in the West Bank over the past 24 hours and demolished the home of a Palestinian man accused by Israel of terrorism. This week, 15 U.S. House Democrats wrote a letter to Secretary of State Antony Blinken urging him to stop the Israeli government's planned expulsion of Palestinians from the Masafer Yatta villages in the occupied West Bank, arguing the expulsions would be a violation of the Geneva Convention and would amount to a war crime. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control is investigating a case of suspected monkeypox in Georgia, the 18th such case in the U.S. this year. It's one of 550 cases seen across 30 countries detected around the globe this year. On Wednesday, the World Health Organization said the virus has likely been spreading undetected for some time outside of West and Central Africa, where the disease has large animal reservoirs. This is WHO Emergencies Director Mike Ryan.
There are thousands and thousands of cases of monkeypox every year in Africa, and there are deaths every year. And our concern now is real. We have a concern about this disease spreading in Europe. But I certainly didn't hear that same level of concern over the last 5 or 10 years. So I think this is a lesson. These diseases will continue to emerge. They will continue to pressure. They will continue to cross the species barrier. The question is, are we in a position to collectively respond? Are we in a position to share resources in order to stop onward transmission of these diseases within human communities?
White House COVID-19 coordinator Dr. Ashish Jha is warning the United States faces new waves of unnecessary deaths unless Congress approves new funding to fight the coronavirus. Republicans have refused to back a $10 billion compromise COVID funding bill, down from more than $20 billion, demanding the Biden administration keep in place a Trump-era ban on asylum claims at the U.S.-Mexico border. On Wednesday, Pfizer and BioNTech finalized an application to the FDA for emergency use of a three-dose COVID vaccine for children under age 5. FDA advisors are scheduled to meet June 15th to discuss the plan. Meanwhile, new data shows deaths among seniors 65 and older soared during the winter wave of Omicron infections after the virus evolved new ways to circumvent immunity from vaccinations and prior infections. President Biden admitted Wednesday he was not aware of how great an impact the Abbott plant shutdown in February would have on infant formula supplies until April. In a White House meeting with the country's largest infant formula manufacturers yesterday, except Abbott, spokespersons from two manufacturers explicitly said they'd recognized from the start how huge a problem the formula shortage would eventually become when Abbott closed one of its plants in February. A whistleblower sent a 34-page report to the Food and Drug Administration last October, alleging unsanitary conditions at the Abbott factory, but it took over 4 months for the FDA to take action. In this time, one infant died from contaminated formula, another two were hospitalized, a second infant died from tainted formula in late February. The Justice Department has stepped up its criminal investigation into the creation of fake slates of pro-Trump electors looking to overturn Joe Biden's presidential victory in 2020. That's according to the New York Times, which reports the probe has a particular focus on the team of lawyers that worked on behalf of Trump, including John Eastman and Rudy Giuliani. Meanwhile, a newly surfaced recording of Republican Party operatives meeting with grassroots activists last October reveals a multi-pronged GOP strategy to target and potentially overturn votes in Democratic precincts around the country. In the recording obtained by Politico, a Republican National Committee staffer outlines a plan to train and install volunteers to challenge voters at Democratic-majority polling places. Matthew Seyfried, the RNC's election integrity director for Michigan, also said Republicans are setting up a network of party-friendly district attorneys who could intervene to block vote counts at certain precincts.
Truly, it's going to be an army, right? We are going to try to recruit lawyers. We're going to have more lawyers than have ever been recruited, because let's be honest, that's where it's going to be fought, right?
The Department of Education said Wednesday it will cancel $5.8 billion in student loan debt for borrowers who attended the now-defunct network of for-profit schools known as Corinthian Colleges. It's the largest one-time discharge of debt ever made by the Department of Education, a report by the legal organization the Project on Predatory Student Lending found for-profit schools, quote, systematically targets prospective Black and Latinx students, encourage them to take out federal student loans, and leave students with a worthless degree and debt that they are unable to repay, unquote. In Florida, abortion providers have filed suit to block a new law banning abortion after 15 weeks of pregnancy. The Center for Reproductive Rights said in a statement, quote, the Florida Supreme Court has long held their state constitution protects the right to end a pregnancy. That means even if Roe fails, abortion should remain protected in Florida and this ban should be unblocked, unquote. Barring a court injunction, Florida's 15-week abortion ban is set to take effect on July 1st. A jury has decided in favor of actor Johnny Depp in a defamation suit against his ex-spouse, actor Amber Heard, awarding him $10 million in damages. The jury also found in favor of Heard in a countersuit she'd filed against Depp, saying his legal team falsely accused her of fabricating claims, awarding her $2 million. A major component of the case was an op-ed Heard wrote about her experience with intimate partner violence, published in the Washington Post in 2018, at the height of the Me Too movement. Activist Tarana Burke's Me Too movement organization has issued a statement acknowledging the, quote, mockery of assault, shame, and blame, unquote, over the weeks of the trial, calling it a toxic catastrophe and one of the biggest defamations of the movement. And a warning to our audience, this last headline contains graphic footage and descriptions of police violence. In Brazil, protesters are demanding justice for Genivaldo Jesus Santos, a Black man diagnosed with schizophrenia who was killed by federal police in the city of Umbaúba on May 25th. Video of the incident shows a pair of officers trapping Santosh inside a vehicle after releasing a tear gas canister inside. A medical examiner later determined he died of asphyxia. On Wednesday, hundreds of protesters marched through Sao Paulo demanding justice.
Genivaldo foi torturado.
Genivaldo was tortured for a crime he did not commit. A black man with mental health issues. The family begged for his life, but they were not heard.
Many Brazilians are comparing the death of Genivaldo Jesuí Santos to the police killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis, which took place exactly 2 years ago. Santos's killing came just days after police killed at least 25 people during a raid on a favela in Rio de Janeiro. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Nermeen Sheikh. Hi, Nermeen.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Friday marks the 100th day of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. There appears to be little progress on talks to end the war. France, Germany, Italy are pushing for a negotiated settlement, but the U.S. and U.K. are rejecting such calls. The Biden administration is now planning to sell Ukraine drones that can carry Hellfire missiles. This comes in addition to a U.S. plan to send Ukraine an advanced artillery rocket system that can strike Russian targets up to almost 50 miles away. Meanwhile, the head of U.S. Cyber Command has admitted for the first time the U.S. has carried out offensive cyber operations to help Ukraine. In a new op-ed in the New York Times, President Biden writes, quote, "We do not seek a war between NATO and Russia. As much as I disagree with Mr. Putin and find his actions an outrage, the United States will not try to bring about his ouster in Moscow." He went on to write, "We do not want to prolong the war just to inflict pain on Russia." Unquote. Russia's blasted the weapon transfers, saying the U.S. is, quote, deliberately pouring oil on the fire. This all comes as Russia moves closer to seizing the Donbas region in eastern Ukraine. The governor of Luhansk says Russia now controls more than 70% of the key city of Severodonetsk. By capturing the city, Russia would control almost all of Luhansk. In Washington, President Biden's meeting with NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg at the White House. On Wednesday, Stoltenberg held a joint news conference with Secretary of State Antony Blinken, who said the war might continue for many months.
We can't predict how this is going to play out, when this is going to play out. As best we can assess right now, we are still looking at many months of conflict. Again, that could be over tomorrow if Russia chose to end the aggression. We don't see any signs of that right now.
We're joined right now by Anatol Levin, senior fellow at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, author of Ukraine and Russia, A Fraternal Rivalry. His latest piece in The Atlantic headlined, Cold War Catastrophes the U.S. Can Avoid This Time. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Anatol. In your piece, you write that U.S. policy today is in danger of making some of the same mistakes of the early years of the Cold War. The stage is much smaller, but the danger is in some ways greater. Explain.
Well, I drew attention to the way that George Kennan's vision of the containment of the Soviet Union in Europe was turned into a global crusade against communism. And the way in which conflicts that should have had nothing to do with the Soviet Union and Europe were portrayed as central to American security. I'm thinking of Vietnam in particular, but also the way in which across the world, the United States lined up with anyone who called themselves anti-communist. And that, of course, led to a string of disasters. The United States overthrew a liberal nationalist in Iran, reinstalled the dictatorship of the Shah, and eventually, of course, got the Islamic Republic as a result. American backing for right-wing coups in Central America led to what, in other circumstances, the United States would have called genocide. And, of course, at home, you have McCarthyism, whereby a really actually tiny communist presence and threat within the United States was portrayed as a threat to the American Republic and the threat of a communist revolution, which has, you know, helped to poison in many ways aspects of American political life ever since. So what I was saying was, today it is entirely correct to help Ukraine to defeat and contain Russian aggression in Ukraine. But if this is turned into instead a kind of permanent crusade against Russia, this is both intellectually false, very dangerous for the United States, and of course disastrous for any chances of peace in Ukraine, because it points, as certain Biden administration officials have suggested, and as of course several European governments have suggested, that this must be a war not just to defend Ukraine, but to impose a comprehensive defeat on Russia. Now, why I say that this is in some ways more dangerous than in the Cold War is that in the Cold War, both American and Soviet governments were very careful, whatever proxy wars they waged elsewhere in the world, with, of course, horrible results in Africa, in Asia, they didn't wage them in Europe because the threat of escalation to nuclear war was too great. Well, now, of course, we see a proxy war in Europe. And the danger, of course, if the West does aim for a complete defeat of Russia, is that there will be an escalation, not, I think, towards a deliberate use of nuclear weapons, but to what used to be called and should still be called brinkmanship. And, of course, the problem is if you go in for nuclear brinkmanship, there's always a chance you'll fall off the brink.
Anatole, what indications are there? I mean, obviously, within Europe, there are divisions now on how to deal with the invasion. France and Germany have been speaking regularly to both Putin and Zelensky. But is either side at the moment interested in negotiating a peace settlement?
Russia at this moment, I think, is not. Because for Putin to be able to claim some sort of success in what has in fact been a disastrous war for Russia, Russia needs to occupy the whole of the Donbass region, because Russia before the war recognized the whole of the Donbass as independent from Ukraine. But so far, Russia has not actually managed to conquer the whole of the Donbass. And although, as we heard a few minutes ago, Russia is close to capturing the whole of Lugansk Oblast region, it's still very far from capturing the whole of the neighbouring region of Donetsk. So as long as the Russians think they can do that, I think they will go on grinding forward. But either if they can capture the whole of the Donbass, or if they are in fact, which is also entirely possible, simply fought to a standstill in the Donbass, then I think there is a good chance that Russia will in fact offer a ceasefire and peace negotiations, simply because they have lost so many men and so much equipment. And of course, if they go on and on losing at this rate, of course, Ukraine is also losing, but Ukraine is getting a great deal of help from the West. So at that point, I think there will be a chance of peace negotiations, but not today.
But, you know, even if, as you point out, of course, the war has been disastrous for Russia, and despite arms shipments to Ukraine, the war has also been disastrous for Ukraine. And it's unclear the extent to which Zelensky has offered, made reasonable offers towards a peace settlement with Russia as recently as last week, saying that Ukraine would be willing to accept a pre-invasion status quo, that is, relinquishing the desire to reclaim annexed Crimea. Could you talk about that? I mean, what is Zelensky's position and what is the hesitation on Russia's part to agree to this? Is the idea that Russia wants to, as is happening now, take more territory in the East and will not agree to a settlement until they've done so, that Russia is not willing to simply go back to pre-invasion lines?
Well, as I said, I think, well, quite obviously, Russia is trying to take the whole of the Donbass region. Russia has, I think, quite clearly abandoned hopes of conquering the whole of Ukraine or reducing the whole of Ukraine to a, again, to a Russian dependency. I mean, that's gone. The Russian army is just not capable of it. As far as the signals from the Ukrainian side, however, that these have been extremely mixed, and Zelensky himself has given mixed signals, you know, on a week-to-week and sometimes even a day-to-day basis. The thing is, though, that Zelensky has not offered to recognise the Russian annexation or Russian sovereignty over Crimea or the independence of the Donbass separatist republics in the territory they held before February. He has said that these issues could be compartmentalised and negotiated, but he hasn't said Ukraine will agree to give them up. My sense is that, as I say, given how much Russia, you know, the Russian army has lost in this war, if Zelensky would offer, I mean, it would have to be wrapped up, of course, as referenda under international supervision and accompanied by a treaty of neutrality. But if Zelensky were to offer that, it might be enough for Putin to claim success, because obviously, I mean, if you're going to get the Russians to agree to a settlement and withdraw from all the additional territory they've conquered, then, you know, I know this is very, very difficult for Ukraine and indeed the West to offer. But as Henry Kissinger and others have said, you have to give Putin a way out. You have to give him some opportunity to claim that Russia has gained something through this dreadful war. That, however, is where, well, obviously, the question of whether you actually want to give Putin a way out comes up. And it is over that issue that problems between some of the Europeans, the French, Germans, Italians, as you say, and America and Britain could emerge in the weeks and months to come.
And what difference would it make if the U.S. changed its position? I wanted to get your comment on the latest weapons that are being sent there. Henry Kissinger, the former Secretary of State, known for supporting coups from Chile to the murderous regime in Argentina to Vietnam, was pushing Zelensky, offering global criticism, saying he should offer some land or agree to some land concessions. In fact, although Zelensky fiercely attacked Kissinger, Zelensky himself has said this over and over. He seems to be changing his position. But as the major weapons dealer to Ukraine, what role exactly could the U.S. do? What exactly is it doing wrong right now?
I think that what the United States is doing wrong is not accompanying the supply of weapons, but of course perfectly legitimate, with a serious negotiating strategy and a peace plan. Instead, the Biden administration has repeatedly said, oh, you know, this is purely a matter for the Ukrainians. Well, of course, naturally, the Ukrainian government would have to sign any agreement. But the United States, you know, is running big risks for the American economy, huge risks for the global economy. If you look at food price inflation, huge risks for global instability as a result of food shortages. We see what's happening to energy markets. But also, of course, the United States is running a non-negligible risk of nuclear war. This is the biggest danger of nuclear war that we have seen since the Cuban Missile Crisis, you know, 60 years ago. Now, of course, the United States and NATO, you know, backed and encouraged by the United States, has played an absolutely critical role in arming and helping Ukraine. I mean, despite all the courage of the Ukrainian forces, they would not have been able to stop the Russians if they hadn't also received so many US, Western weapons and so much US intelligence, of course, to help them. So all of that gives the United States a right and also, I would say, a duty to the American people and the Western alliance to come up with a peace plan of its own. Now, there's another reason for this, which is, as you say, Zelensky has you know, suggested, stated, sometimes, you know, ambiguously, because sometimes then he's appeared to go back on it, as you said, but a set of basically reasonable proposals for a peace settlement. Other Ukrainian officials have taken an absolutely opposite line and said that, you know, Ukraine must drive Russian forces out of all the territory that Russia has held since 2014. Now, the point is that if Zelensky's line is to prevail, you know, nobody is looking at Ukrainian internal politics, but if Zelensky's line is to prevail, he will need strong American backing, you know, against his own hardliners. I would also say, by the way, that this, you know, has a relationship to the kind of Ukraine we want to see after the war. You know, Zelensky is a great wartime president, but he is also, you know, by tradition and origin, a liberal and a civic nationalist. That's what we want to see prevail in Ukraine. That's what will have to prevail in Ukraine after the war if Ukraine is to move towards membership of the European Union. Now, there are other forces in Ukraine, as we know, very brave men, no question, tremendous self-sacrifice on their part. But their idea of Ukrainian nationalism would be a disaster for Ukraine and would make it impossible for Ukraine to join the West. So there's also a long-term political strategy involved here about what kind of Ukraine we want to see.
Anatol, finally, you know, the Russians have, of course, condemned this new deal, the military equipment that the U.S. is now providing. And you've spoken just now, and we've been speaking of the various proposals that the Ukrainians, if unevenly, have been presenting for peace. What are the terms that Russia has proposed for a peace agreement, if indeed there has been one? What are the terms under which they would cease fighting and even withdraw from parts of Ukraine?
Well, some of Russia's terms have been very clear. A treaty of neutrality. Which, by the way, Zelensky himself has also proposed, because, as he said, NATO has repeatedly refused to make an early offer of NATO membership for Ukraine. So why not a treaty of neutrality? Now, of course, the details of that and the guarantees Ukraine has asked for as part of that is something that would have to be negotiated. But that's the first thing. Then Russia has asked for denazification, but not always. Sometimes Russia has appeared to drop that demand, then it's come back again. There's been ambiguity on the Russian side as well. It could be, however, that after capturing Mariupol and largely destroying the Azov regiment, which Russia has identified as the principal, what it calls fascist force in Ukraine, that Russia could claim that it has done that itself. So it's not clear whether that will be an obstacle. Then there have been demands for guarantees for the status of the Russian language in Ukraine, and that Ukraine should withdraw laws basically passed over the past couple of years, basically abolishing the Russian language from public life, education, government in Ukraine, and from the media. That, it seems to me, is something that the Ukrainians should do in any case, and without reference to Russia, simply because the Russian and Russian-speaking population, completely contrary to Russia's obvious expectations, has overwhelmingly remained loyal to Ukraine in this war. They deserve recognition of that. This also relates to what I said about what kind of Ukraine we want to see in future. We obviously want a civic nationalist Ukraine, not an ethnic nationalist one. Finally, though, the great sticking point, Russia has demanded recognition of Russian sovereignty over Crimea, which Russia annexed in 2014, and recognition of the independence of the Donbass within the full territory of the Donbass, which Russia does not yet fully occupy. Russia has not yet made any demands about the additional territory it's conquered in southern Ukraine. So that, you know, is not actually on the table. So we presume that Russia would be willing, in principle, to abandon the new territory it's conquered, to withdraw, if enough of its other demands were fulfilled. But Russian demands are very clear. These remain Russia's formal demands. I mean, the details aren't, but in principle, you know, the main demands are. So it would be, you know, the task of diplomacy is somehow to bring together what Zelensky has offered and what Russia has demanded. Obviously, both sides will have to give something if there's to be an agreement.
Anatole Levin, I want to thank you for being with us. Senior fellow at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, author of Ukraine and Russia. His latest piece in Atlantic will link to Cold War catastrophes the U.S. can avoid this time. He's speaking to us from Leicester, England. Next, we look at an issue seldom discussed, the role of the United States as the world's leading exporter of weapons. Stay with us.
Story window melted finger boy climbing up the story of humanity for truth. It all begins with you. With you, don't you know, it all begins with you, finger boy, mamacita boy, you've been looking fine.
It All Begins With You by Omar Rodriguez-Lopez. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Another mass shooting. It was Wednesday night. Four people shot dead in Tulsa, Oklahoma, after a gunman attacked a medical complex at a Catholic hospital. It's the 20th mass shooting in the United States since the school massacre in Uvalde, Texas, killed 19 fourth graders and two teachers last Tuesday. On Capitol Hill, a bipartisan group of nine U.S. senators met Wednesday to discuss new legislation in the wake of the shooting. Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell said he hoped lawmakers would target what he called the source of U.S. mass shootings.
It seems to me there are two broad categories that underscore the problem: mental illness and school safety.
Mental illness and school safety. He did not mention guns. President Biden said Tuesday much of the violence from mass shootings is preventable after he met with New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern and discussed how her country moved quickly to change its gun laws after the 2019 massacre at a mosque in Christchurch, New Zealand. As we continue our coverage of gun violence in the United States, we turn now to look at an issue seldom discussed, the role of the U.S. as the world's leading weapons exporter. For more, we're joined by two guests. Rebecca Peters is an international arms control advocate, former director of the International Action Network on Small Arms. She's joining us from Guatemala. And Norman Solomon is with us. He's with Roots Action, the Institute for Public Accuracy. He's the author of War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. And he's got a new piece on Common Dreams headlined, How About Some Gun Control at the Pentagon? The weapons of war that maim and kill the big ones and the small. Let's do something to curb them all. He's joining us from San Francisco. We welcome you both back to Democracy Now! Norm Solomon, let's begin with you. Talk about the connection between the massive number of mass shootings in this country, 20 since last week alone, since the Uvalde massacre. And mass shootings are defined as shootings of four or more people, whether they're maimed or they're killed. That connection, and we're all seeing it on our screens now, to what happens abroad and how the U.S. may horribly be the link.
The connections are really hidden in plain sight, and it's really stunning that with all the discourse about gun control and the debates in the political and media arenas, there's virtually no discussion of the crying need for gun control at the Pentagon. And we know that implementing gun control restrictions in other countries has really reduced drastically the shootings, the mass killings with guns. And yet it's off the media map because of the internalized militarism of mass media and the political establishment in this country to talk about the huge amount of gun usage by the Pentagon. When you look at the stats, we know that about 19,000 people a year on average in the United States are killed with shootings. And when you look at the stats from the Cost of War Project of Brown University, you see that in the last two decades, a comparable number of civilians have been killed by the U.S. military. And that really understates the extent of really the murder using weapons. You know, we talk about assault weapons in the United States. Well, the U.S. Pentagon is wielding a huge array of assault weapons in many countries around the world. And the figure of about 19,000 average civilian deaths since 2001 caused by the U.S. military really understates, for one thing, those are just the direct effects, the destruction of infrastructure. And the less direct deaths are several fold times that 19,000 average per year. And then, as the great journalist Anand Gopal said on this program last summer, the official estimates of deaths caused by U.S. military actions in Afghanistan are woeful underestimates. So what we have is this sort of hidden conceit in the United States in so many different realms that, oh, yeah, we're going to talk about whether to have gun control in the United States. Well, we should, and it should be implemented. But until we have a serious curtailment of the militarism of the Pentagon and the U.S. government, then tacitly what the U.S. society is saying in silence is that the grief of some people in the United States who have loved ones who are killed with weapons because of a lack of gun control inside the country, that grief is really, really important. And it is, and we should recognize that. But another part of the message is the grief of people in Somalia or Afghanistan or Syria or Iraq, that is completely off the media map because, to be blunt about it, the tacit message from U.S. media and political power structure, the elephants and the donkeys in the living room, they are essentially saying in silence, we don't care about the grief of people elsewhere in the world. Not only that, but we particularly don't care when the U.S. military is causing the grief.
Rebecca Peters, you, of course, were the former director of the International Action Network on Small Arms. I'd like to ask about the role that the U.S. has played in advancing or blocking treaties at the U.N. that govern the arms trade. The U.S., of course, the largest exporter of military equipment worldwide. And if you could speak specifically about the arms trade treaty, which the U.S. played a major role in crafting, but the Trump administration pulled out of a few years ago, and the Biden administration has not rejoined.
Yeah, thanks. No, it's the point that Norman makes about U.S. arms exports in general and the damage they do applies, of course, absolutely to the question of guns, which in UN parlance are called small arms. The UN, the US is the biggest producer of guns in the world and also the biggest exporter, both illegally and legally. So these two streams of guns flow out from the U.S. into other countries and cause havoc, including where I am in Guatemala. And within the U.N. started to try to get countries to work together to strengthen their controls on guns around 2000. So for 20 years, there's been an effort within the U.N. And during most of those discussions, the U.S. has really taken a pretty unhelpful position in the very beginning, there was the main agreement relating to guns in the UN is called the Program of Action, and that was developed in 2001. And a really important point that was not able to be included in that agreement because of the US's insistence was there's no mention of any regulation of guns in the civilian population, although almost every other country in the world felt it was important to say, you know, 85% of guns in the world are in civilian hands. Regulation of guns should deal with civilian-owned weapons. But the U.S. refused, and therefore that wasn't able to be included. Later, we were able to develop the Arms Trade Treaty, which is the first internationally binding treaty dealing with trying to link arms sales to, for example, human rights standards. The U.S. would privately say to us, of course, we need this, but they were very concerned by the fact that the American gun lobby felt that the Arms Trade Treaty, or I don't think they really thought this, but the American gun lobby claimed the Arms Trade Treaty was a global ban on the Second Amendment. And so the U.S. Definitely made the whole negotiation of that treaty harder. But it finally was adopted and it's come into force. And unfortunately, yeah, now as the U.S., the biggest producer of military equipment, has not actually ratified it. And so, I mean, it doesn't obviate the need for the treaty, obviously, even if the big producer hasn't ratified it. But still, obviously, it would be really, really helpful if the biggest producer of weapons would join the international treaties governing and agreements governing that industry.
And could you speak, Rebecca, just earlier this week on Tuesday, the Prime Minister of New Zealand, Jacinda Ardern, met with President Biden, in which, of course, among the issues they spoke of was gun control. Explain what happened in New Zealand following the Christchurch massacre and the significance of this meeting between the two.
Well, New Zealand was an example of a country that got it wrong once and later got it right. New Zealand was supposed to be part of the changes that came about in Australia's gun laws in 1996, because those changes were under a body called the Australasian Police Ministers Council. And Australasia means Australia and New Zealand. So when Australia changed its gun laws to ban semi-automatic rifles and shotguns, New Zealand should have adopted that change too. But at the time, the gun lobby in New Zealand persuaded the New Zealand government that there was no need for that, and therefore New Zealand didn't change its laws in 96. Then in 2019, the massacre at the mosque in New Zealand was actually carried out by an Australian who would not have been able to do that in Australia, wouldn't have been able to get the weapons, but went to New Zealand where he was able to get assault weapons and murdered over 50 people. It was a massacre. It was also an act of terrorism. It was also an act of white supremacy. And then New Zealand did change its laws. And I suppose I was interested to see Jacinda Ardern's comments in the U.S. I mean, she said that New Zealanders just saw it was a problem that needed to be solved. New Zealanders are practical people, and she also was saying and said, of course, it's up to the U.S. what it does. We can only tell you what we do in other countries, and that's true for Australia as well. But I think that the more that the U.S. government and the U.S. people can hear from the leaders of other countries, which are culturally similar, which are, you know, where the lifestyle is similar, from other countries that can see when there's a problem, fix it, that I'm hoping that will, you know, give a bit of force to a bit of impetus to change in the U.S.
So we will end with the words of New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern delivering the Harvard University commencement speech last week. She was met with a standing ovation.
On the 15th of March 2019, 51 people were killed in a terrorist attack on two mosques in Christchurch, New Zealand. The entire brutal act was live streamed on social media. The Royal Commission that followed found that the terrorist responsible was radicalised online. Now, in the aftermath of New Zealand's experience, we felt a sense of responsibility. We knew that we needed significant gun reform, and so that is what we did.
That was New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern. Rebecca Peters, we want to thank you for being with us, international arms control advocate, former director of the International Action Network on Small Arms, and Norman Solomon, national director of Roots Action and executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy. We'll link to your piece on Common Dreams, How About Some Gun Control at the Pentagon. Stay with us. Salt. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. The president of Senegal, Macky Sall, who chairs the African Union's, warned the European Union that Africa is facing a food crisis with soaring wheat, fertilizer and energy prices combined with increasing food shortages due to the war in Ukraine. Russia and Ukraine are the largest wheat exporters in the world. During an address on Tuesday, Sall also criticized Western sanctions on Russia, saying they're making it harder for African nations to buy food. The African Development Bank says the price of wheat has already jumped 45% on the continent. And the hunger crisis is being felt across the globe, from Afghanistan to Yemen to Ethiopia. We're joined now by Shannon Scribner. She leads Oxfam America's humanitarian work. Last month, Oxfam released a report with Save the Children and the Jameel Observatory titled Dangerous Delay 2, The Cost of Inaction, which found a person is likely dying of hunger every 48 seconds in drought-ravaged East Africa. Shannon Scribner, if you can talk about the extent of the catastrophe.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. So this Dangerous Delay report, which is the second report, we did a previous report almost 10 years ago, and that was during the 2011 Horn of Africa drought, where 260,000 people died, half of which were children. And right now in East Africa, across Kenya, Somalia, and Ethiopia, we are on track for 350,000 Somali children to die. So we are actually worse off than we were 10 years ago. And that sobering statistic of every 48 seconds, one person across Ethiopia, Somalia, and Kenya is dying of hunger today.
Shannon, could you explain what the different causes are for this crisis, from the pandemic to the war in Ukraine and the climate crisis?
Absolutely. So we know that the pandemic over the last, 2 years plus has had a huge impact just globally and in East Africa in particular. It also has caused prices, inflation to skyrocket. It's caused the supply chains to be interrupted. But we've also had the driest season on record in East Africa. And we knew this 2 years ago because we have early warning systems that are telling us a drought is coming. The rains are failing. Malnutrition is skyrocketing. So we knew this 2 years ago. And then we have the conflict in Ukraine that has really exacerbated the crisis in East Africa, as well as West Africa and other places, because of the Black Sea exports that are so important to this part of the world, and wheat, especially that's exported from Ukraine and Russia, that is impacting an already exacerbated food crisis.
Shannon, as you mentioned, of course, the blocking of the ports in Ukraine is in large part responsible for the crisis. The other issue, though, insofar as other wheat producers are concerned, among them France, India, and the US, these countries are facing massive droughts, which will or have already resulted in wheat shortages. So could you talk also about the impact or elaborate on the impact of that, not just the fact that Russia and Ukraine's wheat exports are vastly diminished, but also what's happening as a result of the climate crisis in other wheat-producing countries?
You know, absolutely. I mean, to stick to the report and East Africa and these countries, so 2 years ago, we started hearing about food insecurity because of the drought. We knew that three consecutive rainy seasons had failed. Just in April, we've heard that the fourth rainy season will fail. So there are early warning systems that tell us when a drought is on the horizon. It will tell us when malnutrition is spiking. And so the communities that we've been talking to in those countries are saying, you know, their life is worse off because of the climate crisis. They've had to leave their farms that they can no longer grow anything from, and they're living in internally displaced camps. We have people whose animals are dying. So we had one woman in Somalia who had 150 cows, and she has two cows left. And this is the story that we're hearing across the countries. And now people are worried not just about their animals dying, but they're worried about their neighbors and their family and their friends dying because of the famine-like conditions. We also know that this is an extreme time, and it's an extraordinary time, right, with the pandemic, but also with the conflict in Ukraine. But we are on track by 2030 to actually have 560 disasters a year, and that is related to climate change. So I don't know if this is extraordinary times. So we really need a system that is more responsive to those early warnings, that we're investing in those early warnings. We need to act when they give us the information that a drought is coming, that malnutrition is rising, and that animals are dying. And we're not doing that today.
Shannon Scribner, Oxfam released a report recently that a new billionaire has been created every 30 hours since the start of the pandemic, while a million people could fall into extreme poverty in 2022 alone. Can you talk about this and also the language that's used? We now say things like food insecure. What does that mean? Why aren't we saying hunger and famine straight out?
So the report that you're referring to is called Profiting from Pain, and it's talking about the 20 million people that have died as a result of the pandemic. And over those 2 years, when we've had so many people dying, we've seen an extreme inequality gap between those that are getting richer and those that are getting poorer. So the quotes of the billionaires and how many people are falling into extreme poverty are really striking at this moment in our history. And what we're finding is in East Africa, for example, it's not that people are working less hard. They're working more hard. They are, you know, walking for miles to try to find water, trying to find a pasture or food for their animals. They are doing everything they can to keep their families alive. They are skipping meals, often one meal a day, and sometimes the parents aren't eating. We know that women are eating last or not at all, and they're also preparing any meals that they can find, and they're also responsible for finding those meals. So the billionaires aren't working harder. It's because of the circumstances of the pandemic that they've been able to make a lot of money. And so we really need to think about that. When we have right now in East Africa, there is a humanitarian assistance, I think it's about $4.4 billion, but we only have 3% of the funding. We have funding going to Ukraine, but not to places like East Africa. And in terms of extreme hunger, you know, there is a classification that looks at malnutrition. It looks at water that's available in houses. It looks at how many meals people eat a day. So there's all these factors that it looks at, and it determines where it is. Is it extreme hunger? Is it famine? And it's called IPC 12345. And right now in East Africa, we are in 3, 4, and 5, and 5 is famine. So those are the emergency categories based on people's access to food, based on availability of clean water, and based on the number of calories they're able to take in a day.
Well, Shannon Scribner, we thank you for being with us, leading Oxfam America's humanitarian work. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Felsmeitberg, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Camille Baker, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamaria Studio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Hani Masood. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Stay safe.
And Amanda Smith from Nashville, Tennessee.
Keep it right here on WRCT Pittsburgh.
Everybody ready? Mm-hmm.
Well, hello there. Welcome to episode 2220 of Whiskey Before Breakfast on WRCT Pittsburgh, WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark, Delaware, WTC and WTC HD1 Chattanooga, Tennessee, WKYWLP Kaiser, West Virginia, or Tube City Online Radio from McKeesport, Pennsylvania. I am Mando Richard, your host for Whiskey Before Breakfast, and we've got a wild show for you. We've got a liquored up set at the beginning of the show, a gospel set at the end, and in between, chaos will reign. Our liquored up set's going to contain three new songs and a song I think I've played before, but not this particular version. Let's start off with a brand new single from a gentleman from down in the Atlanta, Georgia area. Here comes Ryan Slice with his new single, Off the Wagon.
When I get to drinking, that's when I get to thinking. But it's 'cause I ain't been thinking that I'd drink. Now if I was to think, I wouldn't start to drink. I'm thinking it'd stop me drinking till I'm drunk. If you drank till you stink, then you get drunk like a skunk. But then thinking about drinking, not what you thunk.